When Beth Macy wrote the book Dopesick, the experience took its toll. Dopesick is the story of the tens of millions of Americans who've suffered from the opioid crisis and the people who helped cause that crisis. It caught the attention of Hulu, which turned it into a TV series starring Michael Keaton as a doctor who lost patient after patient to addiction to a potent painkiller.
Oxycontin.
So just to be clear, you're blaming numerous deaths in your town on just one medication?
Yes, sir.
Beth Macy was left feeling hopeless as she covered the ravages of the opioid crisis. So in her latest book, she's turned her attention to the stories of the people who are working to find solutions, including harm reduction workers. The book is called Raising Lazarus. Macy told us why she chose the name.
It's actually a story that the Reverend Michelle Mathis, who's a harm reductionist in Hickory, North Carolina, tells Christian groups and volunteer groups to help them check their blind spots. I mean, we all have blind spots because we've all been inculcated in drug war. You know, we grew up with drugs are bad, drug users are bad, they're moral failures. And so what Michelle does, I mean, I watched her at one meeting in particular wherein a civic leader stood up and said, I think when they overdose, we should let them die and take their organs. And Michelle tells the story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, and he performed the miracle, but it was up to the people in the community and his disciples to roll the stone away from the tomb and then to bring Lazarus out and unbind him from his burial cloths. And what she says is, it's stinky work. It's messy. You might get a little something on you, but only by getting close to the people affected by this issue can you experience the miracle.
And how does she get close? Because you were with her through a lot of her work. What did you see? What did you experience?
Well, what she's doing is she's reaching out to people with addictions where they are, whether that be under a bridge, in a tent, or whether they have the wherewithal to come to one of her three needle exchanges. When she and her wife, Karen Lowe, started out in 2009 with Olive Branch Ministry, syringe exchange was still illegal in North Carolina. So they would pose as a food pantry, handing out food out of the back of their pickup truck. They would take out like half of the granola bars from a box, and they would put clean needles in. They would put one of their business cards in the box, and the card said Olive Branch Ministry and their phone number, so that if a family member found the card, they'd go, oh, how nice, they're going to church.
By the way, the food is an important component here, because as you say, the people who know most what they need are the people who are addicted themselves, and sometimes they just need food.
Yeah, the food insecurity is through the roof. I remember the one program I wrote about in Batesville, Indiana, they did a survey. And what are your goals? One guy said, I want a second pair of pants. The other said, I wanted to taste salmon for the first time in his life. And she said the first time they put out a snack bowl, they attacked it like a herd of wounded baby antelopes.
And for those who are saying, well, that's not going to help them with their addiction problem, you say what?
I say, go to a needle exchange. What can I help you with today? One man said, he said, I'm hungry. And they gave me a sandwich. And that sandwich was the beginning of me getting invested in the people who were helping me. And, you know, now this man I'm talking about, this is a true story out of New York City. He eventually was able to access treatment, went back to school, got his family back. He now runs a treatment center in Johnstown, New York. And so that's why I started the book in a McDonald's parking lot next to a dumpster, wherein another volunteer with Olive Branch, who is a nurse practitioner, is meeting a person in chaotic use for the first time, a new patient who knows if he doesn't get off the needle that he's going to die.
So this is Tim Nolan that you're talking about from in Hickory, North Carolina. This is an amazing story. You say he has this dusty Prius that operates as his office, and he parks next to this smelly dumpster, and he puts on top of the car test strips and syringes and is about to meet this man who has substance use disorder, who comes up to him and wants help, but doesn't appear to be, at least in any shape, to get it. What happened?
Yeah, he shows up late. He's high. It's the height of COVID, and he's got a broken face mask dangling from one ear. And he's meeting Tim because he tells him first off, like, if I don't get off the needle, I'm going to die. And Tim says, well, let's get you better. And he says, tomorrow I'm going to call in a discount prescription for buprenorphine, which is a medicine for opioid use disorder. It's evidence-based. I'm going to get you that access, which he's never had before. But I want you to know two things. And this is really the crux of the book. One is you can get better. And two, and this is key, don't disappear. So that's this thing of harm reduction where we're going to go to you where you are. And even if you're still in chaotic use, even 2 or 3 days after starting this life-saving medicine, if you return to use or relapse, still meet me here next week. And if you can't come to me, text me and I'll come to you. The largest group of people with opioid use disorder is 40%. They think they can't get better. They don't want to stop using drugs. And part of that is because they haven't been offered access to the treatments. When they've tried to get it, they've been stigmatized.
And it's helpful to know, I think, what these people who have substance use disorder are going through. And you describe in the book how it is that someone from an injured coal mine worker to a baseball player to somebody who had back surgery can take an opioid for legitimate pain and then keep taking it because of how their body reacts to it. How does it work?
According to the prevailing theory, the idea is that, you know, we all have these natural opioid receptors in our brain. And when we take outside opioids like OxyContin or heroin, it just sort of floods those receptors. And it really attacks the brain's reward center, which is where we have our executive decision making. And so that after as few as 5 days, unless you have these external opioids coming in to replace that amount that they got used to, you are starving for them. And the best description I've heard came from an addiction specialist in Arkansas who said, imagine not being able to eat for a month and somebody puts a delicious plate of food in front of you and tells you you can't eat it. And so that's this desperation that most users call dope sickness. And they'll do anything to relieve this excruciating withdrawal, which on its own is not likely to kill them, but it's just like this outsized fear. And every person I've talked to with OUD describes it as, you know, the worst flu times 100. You'll do anything. If your dope man isn't coming until next week, you'll parse it down so you're only using a little bit a day. So it's both psychological and physical.
And despite this really heavy toll, there are people, and you really seek to understand where they're coming from, but people who push back and still feel people who have substance use disorder should be locked up, don't deserve the kind of care that is needed for them, medical care, for instance, shelter. Talk to us about the group of sheriffs that you were invited to speak with in Indiana and their response to what you were saying.
It was the month before COVID, so it would have been February 20, and I was invited to address every sheriff in Indiana. And at the end of the talk, not one person clapped. And finally, one deputy felt sorry for me, but he very slow clapped me. And it was, I mean, Lisa, they had guns. And
they weren't going to use them on you, but
no, they were.
You noticed.
But one sheriff, the one from Scott County, where they had that huge HIV outbreak from injecting Opana, he goes, well, they're clean when they leave my jail. Mm-hmm. And like, that's no understanding of addiction at all. And you've got these sheriffs who are elected, and they're elected on these platforms of being tough on crime. And so that's why it's such a tough nut to crack.
Right. But you also understand what they face when police, for instance, go out into the community. I mean, you know where they're coming from.
Yeah, because the police and a lot of the first responders, they have really felt this hard, too. I have a cop friend in Ohio that I grew up with. And, you know, he's been arresting people since OxyContin first came out. And a couple years ago, he was patting somebody down in an arrest, and he got stuck with a needle. And he knew it was a dirty needle because the guy told him he had hepatitis C, and he had to go through a year of testing. So I like to tell that story because it's like a lot of the police groups are opposed to syringe exchanges still, but it's really making them safe and the community safer too.
it's so easy to be cynical about what's happening, what's going to happen. Are you?
Oh, I'm a little bit of both. You know, I'm hopeful because I start to see that even, you know, yesterday I was giving a talk in Columbus, Ohio, with a bunch of folks that I thought I was going to be really kind of surprising them with all my talk about harm reduction. I'm for safe consumption. I'm for anything that gets people connected to systems of care, anything, and that's healthy and safe for them and helps them use and stay alive. And I got a standing ovation. I mean, it shocked me. It was exact opposite of the Indiana sheriffs, you know. So I'm going to be talking in Indiana again soon, Lisa. So I'll let you know if it's gotten any better there.
Thank you so much. Beth Macy, author of Raising Lazarus, Hope, Justice, and the Future of America's Overdose Crisis. Thank you, Beth.
Thanks, Lisa.